Welcome to this episode of the Spinoza Triad. In this episode, though, it's the Spinoza Duo, with myself and Richard. Pressure of work and family commitments, and all the things that get in the way, have prevented Dan from joining us this time. However, Richard and I did find the time to, in our usual way, share some views and exchange some ideas. As a child, like most children, I was warned about the danger of strangers. Not in any way that would terrify, but in the usual way that most parents attempt to guard their children against one of the dangers they perceive to be out there in the world. As I did with my children, don't go with strangers. If someone asks you to get into a car, what do you say? And so on. Like most people, that's probably my first awareness, somewhat after my first awareness of death, and somewhat before my first awareness that my parents were, after all, not infallible. It was my first awareness that the world contained bad people. And I probably thought, in my own childish way, why isn't everyone good, kind, friendly, caring, dependable? After all, we're all sharing the same journey through this mortal world. It wasn't such a childish thought. Looking back on it, it might occur to us all. Why are some people cruel? And then more troubling, are we all capable of cruelty, of brutality, of violence? Later on in life, you might look back on things done and said selfishly and wonder why you did them or said them. Partly because of an awareness of the number of books whose title contains the name or the word psychopath, Richard and I began our discussion with the starting point of psychopaths. During our discussion, we use the term regularly, referring to psychopathy and psychopath, rather than sociopath. The distinction is somewhat ambiguous. Some will indicate that sociopaths are more obviously unpleasant, and others that psychopaths are more violent and dangerous, more devious. The terms are used interchangeably. However, we will use the term psychopath, as it is used in books such as John Ronson's The Psychopath Test, or The Wisdom of Psychopaths by Kevin Dutton, or famously, the man who devised the original psychopath test, still used largely as a means of determining the traits of psychopathy, Robert Hares, Without Conscience. We also refer to Kent Keel, The Psychopath Whisperer. We think about normative ethics, the media, the problem of evil, nature and nurture, self-determination, and our own experiences. I hope you enjoy listening as we share our thoughts. Psychopaths are a topic that you can sell a book and a podcast, probably. If by the question, why psychopaths, you're asking, Richard, why are we so interested in them? I think that's one side of our conversation. If the other part of why psychopaths is why they exist, given that the advantages of communality, the advantages of caring and supportive human beings seem to be so outrageously obvious, then why do psychopaths, why have they emerged? What is it, are psychopaths extremely rare examples of profound mental illness? Or, as people like Robert Hare in his book Without Conscience, or Kevin Dutton in The Wisdom of Psychopaths, another book which essentially proposes that there's some kind of evolutionary socio-cultural advantage in having among us, having among the population, psychopaths. They're actually, you know, they're creative and they drive kind of society forward. They are the innovators, ruthless bastards though they may be. They are what, you know, you need a few ruthless bastards among us. I don't buy that at all.
Well, I think he mentions that, though, in that book, doesn't he, Dutton? He says that, maybe in that book I saw an interview with him, he says that really the language of nature-nurture is kind of outdated in this sense, and we should be looking more in terms of epigenetics. And by that, I'm assuming he means genetic factors that are turned on and off through experience, you know, sort of social and I guess almost cultural, but definitely sort of environmental. And I mean, one of the things there, if you compare those two books, so Robert Hare's, I think, written, he's the guy that actually came up with the psychopath checklist. He sort of centralized the idea. So he's got a 40-point checklist. It's revised as well now, I think, where psychologists around the world can have a universal kind of gauge they can use to sort of compare psychopath characteristics and a kind of cluster of characteristics. And one of the things I noticed with, I looked at the Robert Hare one, The Wisdom of Psychopath. There was another one called The Psychopathic Whisperer, which was really good. As you sort of go along, so I think the Robert Hare book, so it first came out in 1993, so it's quite old. Since then, a lot of the research into this area is used with fMRI brain scans now. You've got what was initially, almost a qualitative judgment formulated around a series of questions. You would need a clinician to carry out the test, but it's a series of questions where you're looking for these characteristics. Now that's combined with the brain scans, brain imaging.
If you can see differences in brain activity among certain people who hold certain beliefs, but not beliefs, attitudes, they appear to show no signs of remorse or guilt, or they seem to be very excessively self-centered. And you can see that difference in the brain. Like, I mean, in the Robert Hare book, the ECG of psychopaths, just the brain wave pattern, he says, is very strange among one in about 100 people, or one in a few hundred people. So lots of people have these odd brain wave patterns. And today, of course, you can look at little parts of the brain firing up and interacting, and that may show a similar thing, mightn't it? It might show, as you say, that either over the evolutionary genetics or epigenetics in our lifetime, that somehow some people's brains are wired differently.
I think as well, there's a guy, James Fallon, so I think he was a neuroscientist. He'd been brain imaging, I don't know if it was in prisons, like violent offenders, or, you know, you run an experiment, and he took his family's brains and he ran them all through his imaging, and he comes across one, and it's like the amygdala and the orbital cortex, the front of the brain here, and it was just dead. And he was like, oh wow, you know, I've got one. And then when he goes through the data, it's his brain. It's actually him.
No, that's horrible.
So and then he started to talk to his mother or his aunt or someone, who then goes on to say that on the mother's side of the family, there were a number of cases of murders, of people killing people, family relations. And his argument is that they are genetic in that sense. But again, he's quite keen to point out that, you know, it's only one determinant on you becoming violent. People can have this brain abnormality, but without it actually becoming an issue.
Well, that takes you back to what triggers or what fires off what makes the difference between someone with that brain abnormality. It's a terrible, it's like going into your family tree. I've started doing my family tree, and it's getting bigger and bigger and bigger. Well, I found I'm related to half of South London, as it turns out. I mean, because you keep going sideways, and cousins are related to distant people. And the family tree, it'd be terrible to go into your family tree and start seeing, you know, yes, what happened to him? He was locked up for killing five people. What happened to him? Oh, that person, he's known as Horace the Mad. Oh, no, for Christ's sakes. Yeah, somehow. It's gay.
Yeah.
But yeah, so that begs the question, what fires off, what triggers, what is the difference?
I can't profess to know much about the inner workings of the brain, but broadly speaking, the two areas, it's quite interesting, that aren't firing properly in a psychopath, and largely they're dead in a relationship. Well, not dead, but they're not firing up properly between each of them, but either individually, is the amygdala, which is part of the limbic system, which is kind of emotional impulses. It balances anger, sex drives, you know, addiction. In old Freudian, I'm guessing you're looking broadly at a kind of id. area, you know, not that we would use that language nowadays, I guess, in this sense, but it's those urges. And then the orbital cortex, like the old-fashioned superego, conscience, it's the moral processing. So you've got this issue of urges and that aren't balanced. You would act, the brake, if you like, at the front would say, perhaps you should not do this, isn't a great idea, isn't necessarily there. So I listened to one of the interviews, I think it was Robert Ressler, the FBI profiler, and he said it isn't necessarily that, and he's talking about serial killers here, but I'm going to lump this, I'm assuming that most serial killers are psychopathic, but he was saying it's not necessarily that there's an overwhelming urge to kill, it can be quite a small one, but or a curiosity. But on many of these people that score very highly, there's no break at all. There's no reason why you shouldn't. You know, so it's not, I just found that quite interesting.
Yeah, absolutely. It's this curious, well, view of the psychopath isn't the raging lunatic with an axe. That can be charming, deeply manipulative, highly empathetic, but selectively empathetic. We talked about this the other day, how they can read your emotions really well. There's not a problem with misunderstanding what you're saying. In fact, they read them too well. They can see your weaknesses. And that, I mean, I haven't encountered people like that since I left school. The school bully, the kind of kid you avoided because they could somehow almost smell your fear. You know, they knew your weaknesses. They could tell from the way you observed things and said things that you were afraid of this. Your insecurities about your looks or your fear of that teacher that you were trying to hide or your fear of them that you're trying to hide. And then the charming ability to manipulate. On a lesser scale, I've certainly met people and talked to people who you realise is a sort of convincing in a way that you, as an intelligent person, as a person you think is going to evaluate other people very critically and know people, and you realise you're being manipulated. So the heightened qualities of the psychopath is frightening because, most of us are sheep and they're wolves, aren't they? You know, and we go our little sheepy lives quite comfortably, expecting the best of people, trusting strangers, relying on politeness in others, relying in sensitivity in others, until you encounter someone like that.
Gary Ridgway, I remember reading a book on him, the Green River Killer. He stabbed boy when he was, I think he was about early teens, and it was another young lad. He said, why did you do it? He goes, I just wanted to know what it felt like, just to stab someone. No kind of, it was just a curiosity. You also have the psychopath personality struggles with finding emotional hits, if you like. They don't really experience fear in the same way we do. They don't experience love. So trying to get anything takes a lot of simulation. So they're, by definition, they're very impulsive and look for satisfaction through extreme behaviours. But that's balanced, I suppose, in some respects, by being very manipulative as well. So, I mean, they're a real problem, aren't they? My interest in this area was first sparked in conversation with, I think it was Lynn. John and I worked with her for many years. Really intelligent and thoughtful person. She was a sociologist. Before sociology, she worked in prisons doing like psychometric testing on. And I remember getting to a conversation with her once about, we were just arguing around the sort of social construction or the sort of environmental arguments around genetically determined responses for the way people develop. And we were talking about the brain, and I was saying about psychopathy. You know, I'd sort of looked around it because it does put a spanner in the works. If you're saying that 1% of the population are born bad, as it were, then obviously you would probably have a scale of people that are born good, and then you've got everyone else in the middle. You've got this, in many respects, for a subject like sociology, it becomes very critical of that because you've got this whole area of genetic determination. But she said that with neuroplasticity, this kind of thing, early on experiences will cause the brain to develop and change within a certain way anyway. So what you can assume to be a genetic thing, if you like, it is in itself shaped. I think, is there a philosophy of psychopaths? I think we can find some space for that, especially when we look at the sort of cultural variant. But to think of there being people who are wired in a predatory sense, who are, I think that Fallon calls them interspecies predators that prey on other people. And even if they're not necessarily violent, that their whole social world is one of opportunity. It's not that they don't understand other people's emotions or empathy. They just don't actually feel it. You can know that red means stop, but you don't feel it.
The film that jumps to mind is No Country for Old Men. And when the Woody Harrelson character is trying to explain him, and he says, Segur is an oddly moral person. He's got a deeply powerful moral ethic. And when he, at the end of the film, when he's killing the young woman, and she, you know, the wife of the guy that found the money, and she says, why are you doing this? And he goes, well, people always say that. Why am I doing this? Why am I doing this? Because I said I would. I made a promise. I promised your husband I'd kill you if he didn't do what I said. Well, he didn't do what I said. I made a promise.
In that outline there, John, you can see there's no balance of emotion. It's not working properly. In a person without psychopathy, they say, you know, I've made a promise, but probably shouldn't kill you.
I'm guessing this isn't the future you had pictured for yourself when you first clapped eyes on that money. Don't worry, I'm not the man who's after you.
I know that. I've seen him.
You've seen him? Man, you're not dead.
Huh. What's this guy supposed to be, the ultimate badass?
I don't think that's how I'd describe him.
Well, how would you describe him?
I guess I'd say he doesn't have a sense of humor. His name's Segur.
Sugar?
Segur. Anton Segur. You know how he found you?
Yeah, I know how he found me.
It's called a transponder.
I know what it's called. He won't find me again.
Not that way.
Not anyway.
Took me about 3 hours.
Yeah, well, I've been immobile.
No, you don't understand. What do you do?
I'm retired.
What did you do?
Welder.
Settling, MIG, TIG?
Any of it. If it can be welded, I can weld it.
Cast iron?
Yeah.
I don't mean braze.
I didn't say braze.
Pop metal.
What did I say?
Were you in NAM?
Yeah, I was in NAM.
So was I.
So what does that make me, your buddy?
Look, you gotta give me this money. I got no other reason to protect you.
It's too late. I spent it. About $1.5 million on whores and whiskey, and the rest of it just sort of blew it in.
How do you know he's not on his way to Odessa?
Why would he go to Odessa?
Kill your wife.
Maybe he's the one who needs to be worried about me.
He isn't. Yeah. You're not cut out for this. You're just a guy who happened to find those vehicles. I'm across the river at the Hotel Eagle. Carson Wells. Call me when you've had enough. I can even let you keep a little of the money.
I was into cutting deals, why wouldn't I just deal with this guy, Sugar?
Oh, no, you don't understand. You can't make a deal with him. Even if you gave him the money back, he'd still kill you just for inconveniencing him. He's a peculiar man. Might even say he has principles. Principles that transcend money or drugs or anything like that. Not like you. Yeah, he's not even like me.
Well, he don't talk as much as you. I give him points for that.
For anyone who hasn't seen the film No Country for Old Men, I highly recommend it, by the way. It's one of the Coen brothers' films, 2007. It's based on a book by Cormac McCarthy. And it's exploring, really, through several characters' ethics, different approaches to how to live the good life. I mean, you've got the sheriff, played by Tommy Lee Jones, Sheriff Bell, whose old-fashioned conservative values and seeking to understand a world of increasing violence that he fails to understand, feels that he's left behind. Maybe that's from the title, No Country for Old Men. As he gets older and approaches retirement, he realises he can't comprehend this world of violence. Then you've got the Woody Harrelson character of Carson Wells, who's a kind of pragmatist who understands Segur, and the character played by Josh Brolin, Llewellyn Moss, whose one act of kindness to bring water to a dying man is going to lead to a series of disastrous consequences for him and his family. And then, of course, the psychopath. Unquestionably a psychopath, but not in the terms we've been talking about. I think he's certainly emotionless. He feels nothing, but he's not curious about the world. He has a view. There's this odd rationalism. And I think in that sense, the character of Anton Chigurh is rather like the kind of rationalism we've discussed in the past with the Frankfurt School. The idea that Enlightenment rationalism, scientific rationalism, forming a structure of rational theory can lead you to disastrous and irrational ends, in the sense that the Nazis were deeply rational in their madness. The world we live in is full of rational madness and rules imposed upon a world for purposes that make no sense and yet relentlessly followed through. We see it in the war in Ukraine right now. The Russians and the Ukrainians have absolutely no sane interest, no material interest in fighting each other. Not that Ukrainians are to blame for this war, I'm not suggesting that for a minute. They are the victims of an invasion. But the Russian attack makes no sense for Russia. Its economy makes no sense for its economy, for its people. There's no good reason. The Russians should have happily got on with being corrupt alongside the Ukrainians and nicely made themselves richer. The oligarchs could have sailed around in their ridiculous boats and the world would have gone on peacefully, dully, corruptly. But instead, following the mad logic of Putin, some sort of idea of his own destiny or imagined threats, then the war becomes necessary. And a war of insanity is pursued through a relentless kind of logic.
Could you argue it's almost Kantian? You know, fidelity to one's duty. There's a paper, Glyn Daly, late 90s, he wrote it, and it's a Lacanian sort of psychoanalytic thing that he does. It's a really, really good. It's called Ideology Paradoxes or something like that. And it's the sort of second half of it, he then takes the character from the movie Seven, you know, the Brad Pitt film with, it's pretty, pretty grim film with the guy that's got the seven deadly sins and he kills everyone by a different sin. And in the paper, he then argues that this figure is almost the ultimate Kantian figure because he has pure drive, fidelity to his duty. I think in that paper that he's kind of comparing that. Lacan wrote a paper called Marquis de Sade, The Ultimate Kantian, or something like that. So it's kind of playing on that kind of theme again. But so in some respects, you could argue perhaps that the psychopath does become a kind of warped, ultimate Kantian ethical character.
And the reason that is Kantian, the reason the Marquis de Sade or the character of Chigurh might be Kantian is because if you believe in moral absolutes, but the moral absolute takes you to the place of answering the front door to the guy with the axe who says, I'm come to kill your friend. And you say he's in the living room.
Yeah.
Because I can't lie. I mean, much worse if I lie, because I'm making assumptions about your behaviour. In order to make those assumptions about your behaviour, I'd have to be dishonest. And it's a moral imperative that I'm not dishonest. So there he is. Yes, I mean, Himmler, as the ultimate bad Nazi in a way, is oddly more bad because he's so cold. You know, he doesn't take bribes. He doesn't steal. He loves his family. He's a good father.
Himmler called himself a Kantian, didn't he? You know, he considered himself Kantian. The idea that, look at the hardship that we must go through in order to achieve total commitment and fidelity to his duty. But he has all the characteristics of psychopathy, doesn't he, really? In the literature, they separate the positive and negative aspects of psychopathy as well, because some of the characteristics, like, you know, this very brave, confident, fearless dominance, is also quite useful. You know, Andy McNab, the soldier, the SAS guy, published author, isn't he? But he did the psychopath checklist, and he was wired up to one of these brain imaging. I think it's in the John Ronson book, The Psychopath Checklist. That's the one, yeah.
Yeah, The Psychopath Test.
That's it. McNab says in it, you know, once he says, look, yeah, you've scored very highly in this. And he says, well, that explains quite a lot, you know, because obviously being an SAS, an active soldier, retired, he's probably had to be into pretty, you know, situations that would require the characteristics of a psychopath would just be like a positive trait.
So we admire, I think, people like the fearless warrior, the person who can climb the side of an enormous building without any safety ropes. God, that's amazing. I'm really rather impressed by this, because we're all subject to all sorts of fears all the time. Although we have a sort of optimism bias, we don't think we're going to get run down every morning. We wouldn't leave the house. But we are, of course, we're fearful of all sorts of things. And our society plays on those fears to be genuinely, you know, inoculated against fear. Well, it sounds rather admirable, doesn't it?
Did you see the interview on YouTube with the girl who is, I don't know what she'd be like, sort of late 30s, non-criminal, but psychopath, you know, and it's a series of like sort of four short interviews with her. Absolutely fascinating. And she was saying, like, growing up, they were interviewing, saying, what's your life like? You know, and she's saying, like, growing up, she knew she was different. Didn't know it was psychopathy, but she just didn't feel fear, you know, like other people did. She could see no reason why not to do certain things that their friends thought, you know, probably, you know, you probably shouldn't do that. She just couldn't see why you wouldn't do it. And there's a great bit in there where she's saying about, she says, I understand what fear is. She says it's something like, you know, I'm guessing it's just like any other emotion. She goes, I don't know, like being hungry. I'm thinking, like, that's really someone that's never been frightened. You know, it's absolutely nothing like being hungry at all.
Well, the psychopath isn't a kind of monster, and in the sense that, well, they are a monster, but I mean, they're not a monster in the sense that they're a raving lunatic, so a sort of rabid dog with a foaming mouth and an axe, and neither are human beings. I mean, we are. Is that, you know? I used to sometimes I pose a sort of thought experiment to students, and it'd be something like this. You know, that if it were the end of the world tomorrow, what would you do? Or if there were no authority, no police, no army, nothing, you know, I used to do this before the Purge films appeared, you know. and it's the idea of there's no external restraint on your behaviour. Or you've got a very limited period of time left, in which case the absence of moral restraint is because you're all going to be dead in 24 hours. So there are no consequences. The consequences are taken away, or the external restraint is taken away. What would you do? Well, you know, surprising the number of boys who said, "Well, I'd go out and attack the nearest young woman." because you can never know, because it can't construct the experiment. Are you saying that because there are girls in the class and you want to sound a bit outrageous, or is that a genuine belief? But in fact, How many police are on the streets in most cities most of the time? Very few. We actually do operate in a fairly, I mean, consequenceless world in the short term. I mean, we could get away with far more than we do. Isn't the surprising thing about human beings is that we aren't more violent? Having said that, I don't know what I'm saying there, really, because we are terribly, terribly violent.
I think everyone's capable of very bad things, John, really. And I think if you become acclimatised to them, to violence, I think I've said to you before, I remember being at, I don't know, it was just stuck in my head, but it must have been like 6-7 years ago, being at an MMA fight and being in, you know, we get like the things behind the, you know, the cages in the middle. You've got the rows of sort of seats where the people will hire tables and sit near the cage, and then the corner staff and everything else come sort of round the back. And I remember going round to the front bit, and it just stuck in my head because it was a guy, and this is not, again, it's nothing, it's just, this is just an example, I think, of how you become acclimatized to it. I remember a guy getting finished with, so he's sat on top of the other guy. They call it ground and pounding. So he's basically sat on top, punching and elbowing away. And the guy, he's knocked out sort of just right in front of us. And I remember looking around, I remember walking, turning around, and if you're at that point, I was around, you know, around the sport most days, you know, and it's not that you get acclimatized to or you want anyone hurt or anything, but when you've seen enough people get knocked out, it ceases to be a kind of a thing, really. Oh, they've just been stopped. And I remember turning around to the table to walk away, and there were a few couples there, and they were, like, literally holding their heads and looking in real kind of, like, shock, you know, like, oh, you know, like, really sort of shocked. And I remember walking, turning my back, walking past them and thinking, oh, you know, maybe I've seen too many of these things now, you know. That, becoming acclimatized to something, like in a war, or say you live in a violent society, you become, you know, if you've grown up in a very violent area, you've been surrounded by violence all of your life, you become acclimatized to it. But I don't think that's the same thing, is it? That doesn't make you a psychopath.
I was reading the Stephen Ambrose books about the Americans' progress across France in the Second World War, and how the most dangerous time for a soldier when they were surrendering was the first, like, hour, the first 20, no, immediately when they were surrendering, the first few minutes. If you put your hands up and you surrendered, it was highly likely they'd just shoot you, because they're fired up. They're raging with anger, and they've been trying to kill you. You've been trying to kill them, and you go, no, I won't kill you now. And so an awful lot of people were shot, he says, you know, by Americans, by British, by Germans, just at the moment they surrendered. But if you survive the first 20 minutes or so, they start to see you as a human being. It's likely as not an hour later, they're giving you a cup of coffee and asking you about the war. And what got you into this, mate? Maybe not, but they certainly, they start to see you as a human.
But I mean, that's what PTSD is, isn't it? Often people will come back from war and they can't conceptualize what they've done, you know, and bring it back into being the person that they were. You know, there's a blockage. The two don't meet up. I mean, I remember seeing a thing on military history. And saying that before, I think it was the Second World War, soldiers weren't trained literally to kill. So very often they did like analysis of like bullets on a lot of battlefields and stuff. And people would fire above. They wouldn't actually want to shoot the person in front of them. And then they were psychologically kind of conditioned through training to actually then go and kill people. And that's when you start to get massive rates of PTSD, because, you know, you can train somebody to act instinctively in that setting, but coming back and then, if you like, when they start to rationalize and reflect upon what they've done, it becomes difficult for, you know, these poor people to try and deal with. I mean, so it's just a complicated one with war. What about your area, John, in politics?
Well, I think if you can either take a liberal stroke conservative, liberal, you know, American constitutionalist view, so in the Enlightenment, human beings are bad, probably, and certainly capable of evil. Power corrupts. And therefore, people like John Locke and so on, they're going to say, well, here's the answer. Don't give anyone too much power. You know, create a separation of powers. So they devise a constitution. I mean, the American constitution is premised upon the idea that it's really not a good idea for anyone to monopolize power. Why is that? Because people with power are corrupt. You can see plenty of examples of that all around the world. I mean, it would be a rather good thing, actually, if Putin would accept term limits. if only he decided that something about the something about the Russian constitution meant that you couldn't actually be the premier for more than 5 years, would be a really rather good thing. And that would be probably true of China as well. I mean, but it's highly, you know, it's highly inefficient to keep changing your leaders and changing your government and to one power cancelling out the other. But you're going to sacrifice efficiency, because your overriding belief is that no one should monopolize power because people are fundamentally going to be corrupted by it. The counter to that is the view that if you can only get society right, if you can only construct a society that is equitable, then you don't get the corruption of human beings. People are corrupted by unfair societies. So it's, you know, which drives human behavior, society, or human behavior drives society, or does society drive human behavior? Well, that's kind of the political science question.
What about examples historically, John, of psychopaths? Could you target any political leaders? Or, I mean, Nero springs to mind, doesn't he?
Yeah, Nero gets a bit of a bad, well, no, he doesn't get a bit of a bad press. He did kick his wife to death, or kick his mother to death. That wasn't good. Yeah, so, I mean, Nero, there's the sort of leader who individually murders people, like Nero, or Caligula, who's clearly had some sort of fever in his youth and turned from a quite reasonable human being into a complete lunatic. He turns a horse into a senator, declares war on the sea, marches a legion into the sea, and they all attack the waves. He did a lot of mad stuff. Thought he was a god, therefore he decided, like Mars, he would eat his own offspring. So he pulled the fetus out of his wife and ate it and so on. He's a complete bonkers character, but probably didn't slaughter millions of people. He didn't have the capability to do that, you know. So he was a bad guy to be around because he was either a psychopath or deeply disturbed. Maybe if he was a true psychopath, he would be aware of his own survival. That's a question about psychopaths, is how well they survive. They must survive reasonably well if this genetic tendency is going to be passed on. But after 4 or 5 years, though, Caligula gets done in by his bodyguards because he's too mad. And after about, how long is Nero there? About 8 or 9 years, he gets done in by a coup because he's, you know, in the end, he's too excessive. A true psychopath would be someone, I think, like, well, you're going to say Hitler or Stalin or Mao or Pol Pot.
Because there's an element of narcissism in there as well, isn't there, with psychopathy there? They're very kind of closely interlinked, aren't they? And an interesting point you've been at, John, about how, you know, the sort of longevity of a psychopath. It seems to be that they just seem to get themselves into one lot of trouble after another, and they're either found out socially for ones that are caught. I remember reading John Henry Brown, his name is. He was a kind of a lawyer for famous people. I think he did Jimi Hendrix and a few others. It's an interesting book, because he represented Ted Bundy. It was quite interesting listening to him talk about him, because you get this kind of narrative of this master criminal. It's really, you know, clever, good looking kind of sort of master criminal. But he said, no, not at all. He said, if you had any kind of like sensitivity about people, you could spot him a mile off. You know, he said he was just weird. He was a weird guy to be around. He said like all the right words in the right order, but he said there was something missing. And when he came back after having seen him once, he was dressed in the same stuff as him and just acting like nothing was unusual. And he said it was a very odd kind of character. And that's something else that comes across. These people will give you like this sort of heebie-jeebies, you know, kind of, you know, you can sort of sense that there's something not quite right about this person, which is interesting in itself, isn't it?
Well, it is, because it shouldn't be a very good strategy for operating in society, then, should it? it should be very, you know, if you're obviously so that people can feel so uncomfortable around you, then how does Ted Bundy and indeed other murderers convince people into trusting them and signing over their life savings? Yes, my dear, I love you. You're 80 and I'm only 30, but I love you, and just sign your will over to me. This is obviously true.
yeah. Well, but I think there's a distinction there, isn't it? Between, I mean, Ted Bundy obviously had a lot of other things. I mean, he would clearly have been scored probably at the very top of a psychopath checklist. But within broader society, like you said, some of the positive characteristics of psychopathy, you could see, like, so they say that barristers have a high proportion, surgeons, people where you're in control of life and death or people's destiny, they have a far higher ratio of psychopaths within those fields. So that's perhaps an area where having a lot of those characteristics might not appear odd. If you're extremely overconfident, narcissistic, driven, you know, see people as just as pawns, if you like, to use to manipulate, then you can see how it might be advantageous there, wouldn't it? And you probably could live quite normal existence, a successful existence. Isn't capitalism itself, neoliberal sort of capitalism, it's psychopathic, isn't it? In many respects, it just sees only its continuation, doesn't it, and profit.
I think it's true. We, in a brief discussion before this discussion, we talked about the psychopathic world. And if you took the world as a kind of living organism, it's under attack from a very psychopathic race or life form. It may be, well, that we are on the high road to our own destruction, partly because of this psychopathy that is us humans. I mean, I was thinking the other day, we talked about why does Jeff Bezos build penis-shaped rockets and fire them up to the moon? Oh, not to the moon, to the lower atmosphere, actually, and call it space. It's anything other than ego exercise. And I know that, no doubt, if Bezos defenders would say he gives tons of money to all sorts of good causes. But nonetheless, he's a guy who invented a form of selling stuff that made a lot of money rather fortuitously. And so if you said egocentricity, narcissism, and sort of pathological behaviour, well, that you're describing the human race.
Or at least you're describing the relationship of the human race to the world, to this great organism of the earth, this Gaia that we live on, if you take it, the sort of James Lovelock's sort of idea of the world, then our relationship to the world is very destructive, very pathological, very egocentric. And in that sense, the earth became the ultimate piece of designed obsolescence, since the acquisition of resources produce scarcity, scarcity produces opportunity, opportunity produces profit, and profit releases the greater exploitation and use of resources. It can't go on like this, and yet there's a sort of mad, helter-skelter existence that we've been living on these last 150 years or so, which is either going to end because we choose to end it, or it's going to end because we destroy ourselves. There's a theoretical proposition that the reason we haven't been visited by aliens, and given the life forms in other planets or discovered life in other parts of the universe, is, this given the length of the time that life has been on Earth, a very short amount of time, and the length of time the universe has existed, a very long amount of time, the universe should be teeming with life forms. Well, isn't it just possible that life itself and the consciousness that it produces and the inevitability of the extinction of that consciousness in an individual basis means that all life forms ultimately run themselves into the ground through war or the relentless consumption of their own resources in short-term gain? Maybe capitalism, which destroys us, is the cure for the disease, which is us.
Like, say, elements within capitalism in that sense. And I mean, you say that's reflective of sort of human race. It is, but you've also got the other side of psychopaths, haven't you? You've got, like, if that's on one scale, you have like empaths and people who really feel other people's pain. It's very easy to sit here and say, like, expect the worst with people, but you expect the best as well. I mean, it's just such a mismatch. I mean, that's for me why psychopathy is so interesting, because you've just got this sort of this nugget of bad. Well, and again, like we've said, not necessarily always bad, you know. And then you've got the kind of the sort of cultural, popular culture narratives that go along with psychopaths.
Well, somewhere I listened to a policeman describing his interview with Fred West. And when they realised that Fred West had been, you know, with his wife, had been murdering people. He was a builder, and he's in his house. He'd been inviting people in, discovering they had few connections, and killing them. And he's also torturing and horrible things and burying them under the floorboards. And then he moved to another house and he did the same thing. Well, when they arrested him, when he realizes he's been sort of found out, as it were, he takes them to his house and says, here's in the garden, here's someone, and here's the garden, there's someone over there. And they find these remains in the garden of this previous house. But they say, well, what about your current house? And he didn't want to tell them about that because he was rather proud of his DIY. And he was upset that the police would destroy it if they were digging people up. So he just thought, yeah, I know, I'm not going to tell you about those people because, you know, you'll mess up the plastering, which I did.
But it's idea of a nothingness underneath. It reminds me a little bit of the, you know, banality of evil, where, you know, there's nothing there. Evil, the banality of evil is a void. It's a nothingness. So the psychopath, I remember Tommy Lynn Sells, there was an interview with him on YouTube. He was kind of a, you know, heinous character that went hoboing around, called him a hobo killer, I think, around some states of America. He gets caught in the end because he goes into this trailer where these two young girls are, slits one's throat, and then slits the other girl's throat. And then she pretends to be dead, and he just walks out. And then later on, he's on death row, he's being interviewed. you know, Stone asks him about the little girl, and he looks at him and goes, yeah, he goes, I think about it, if I can just get that little girl still. And I'm thinking, God, dear, you know, it's like it's a little girl. What is wrong with you? You know, and it's kind of like, well, what's wrong with him? There's nothing there.
Well, if then the psychopath is a nugget of bad, not us, just in a different location at time and place, if it isn't a universal quality, if it's a nugget of bad, then what is this thing? Is it evil? Is that what we're talking about? If you said the banality of evil, then we're asking what the characteristics of evil are, and if evil is an absence or whether evil is a presence. And that's much philosophy and theology of the last 2,000 years, is wondering whether if you sweep goodness out of the human personality, out of the human soul, do you create evil? Is evil do we construct on ourselves and on society an edifice of good to suppress the evil that exists at the base of all things, a kind of darkness that is suppressed by the construction of good? Or if you sweep away evil, do you find good, the essential beauty of humanity and nature and the world? And in fact, it is evil that's the edifice and the construct on the surface of good, a kind of deviance. In that sense, is evil an absence or is evil a presence? Or you might say that evil is necessary, you know, a necessary evil. Goodness me, it's a necessary evil in the sense that it has to coexist with good in some sort of Manichaean kind of way, in which you can't have one with the other. It's the opposite side of the coin. And this veil of souls which we are passing through, evil is the fire which tempers the metal, which drives out the sin and produces the purity, and so on and so on. So we're getting a sort of Christian theology of evil, and evil becomes necessary.
So, I mean, from a Jung stuff on the shadow, is it that kind of shadow aspect of our personalities? You know, I remember having a conversation with a friend of mine who's been to, he was in the Bosnian War, and he'd been at war a few times. It's a guy I work with sometimes, and he's a very, very deep thinking guy. Fascinating. So he was a soldier for many years. And I said to him, no, I couldn't kill someone. I just don't think I could. He said, right. He goes, you're in a room now and somebody's pointing a gun at your children. You've got a gun. What do you do? You shoot them. He said, so now you've done, in effect, is it a good thing or a bad thing, but you've killed someone. I think everyone thinks that to an extent, don't they? And I think that's the appeal of psychopathy within popular culture, isn't it? That's the interest.
That is. It is. It's holding a mirror up to ourselves, and it's saying, there but for what could, you know, if it's sort of walking on the edge of the cliff and thinking, well, I won't go too close to the edge because I might suddenly get the idea of throwing myself off. What, I'm not entirely in charge of the things I do, because we all have that suspicion, the sense of our own, the Freudian idea of us not being masters of our own house. I have changed. What would I do under these circumstances? I don't really know. What would I do in warfare? I don't really know. And what would I do if I had no consequences for my actions? I don't really know. And it's the story of Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde. You know, mild mannered Dr. Jekyll, who everybody thinks is a great chap, takes the thing and he releases the id within him. And you think, well, is there a really greedy, horrifying creature within me? Under the right circumstances, will be released. Or if I was placed in a terrific moral a situation of survival, what would I do? You know, if I was starving, would I kill people? You know, the survivors on the Andean mountains. They made a film about the rugby team. Well, the interesting thing about that is that some of them said, look, the only way we're going to survive is to eat frozen dead people. Going to cut strips of their flesh off and eat them. But some didn't. And they starved to death rather than do that. And you might say, well, that's because of their they couldn't overcome their culturally ingrained horror of eating human flesh. Or were they able actually to go all the way to starving themselves to death? Like someone who goes on hunger strike, you know.
Be a psychopath, John's the guy that's busily hacking off slices of his dead mate's leg, you know, rubbing his hands together, putting spices in the pot, you know, getting all excited because it's nearly ready. That's the guy you probably want to avoid, isn't it?
Yeah, or he's made friends with a rather chubby bloke, and he says, "You're not looking so well."
Yeah. I think, I remember the stuff we did on, like, Zizek and the real and fantasy. That links into this as well, I think, for the very thing you're saying. And I wonder whether or not popular culture, you know, all these crime programs on TV, it is that, the way fantasy mediates what Zizek would call the real, you know, that inherent failure, trauma, that which cannot be symbolically represented, you know, that kind of blockage point. Sheer fear or trauma is then mediated from us by these characters. So I can kind of understand the serial killer. I can try and understand it, but it's almost like a halfway point between the other side of that just being this abyss. You know, it's what Nietzsche says, isn't it? Don't look too long into the abyss before it looks back at you, or it's something like that. It's at the front of the Robert Ressler book, because I know that John Douglas, I read his book, was it called Mindhunter or something like that? He had a breakdown in the end. He'd spent so much time with these people. I don't know how to sort of explain it, but there's a primordial aspect of ourselves that finds this kind of thing interesting.
I think the attraction of the serial killer in popular culture, and clearly serial killers are there in popular culture, in true crime recreations, in documentaries and podcasts, and maybe what one we're doing today. I think the attraction of the serial killer is that they operate beyond the boundaries that hem in our little lives. They also seem to be that thing we talked about earlier, going up to the edge of the cliff and wondering if you might throw yourself over. Could I be like that? They're also narrativized. When we hear about the serial killer, we generally hear that about them, or they're represented to us as a kind of cat and mouse game of detective work and so on. So whether we would really, I suspect if we did, as you said earlier, if you met any serial killer and fell into conversation with them, they'd turn out to be odd and dull.
There is obviously a constructive dimension to this, insofar as the language that we're using to talk about it has to be situated within some knowledge body for it to have any legitimacy. And psychology does have, you know, legitimacy there, and evolutionary disciplines do as well. So psychopathy is being situated within that. They're looking, and that's not to say as well, and I'm not going to sit there and say that's, it's all a social construction. I don't believe that at all.
I think it opens up questions of ethics, questions of justice, questions of political science, and questions of consciousness and our own identity. I mean, what exactly am I? The continuation of personality. We use the psychopaths in order to define ourselves as good. And so you say, well, that behaviour is... Because, I mean, there's psychopathic behaviour collectively, like I'm in warfare. So, for instance, in the Second World War, it was quite acceptable to pour bombs onto civilian populations. Well, that's fairly psychopathic, isn't it, really? You'd have thought. Except you say, well, no, it isn't. Because we're doing that rationally, and we're doing it for a good cause, and we're on the side of good. We don't like to do it, but we do it because it's necessary. Well, you know, that doesn't sound a million miles away from where a psychopath might justify there.
It's utilitarian, I suppose, wouldn't it? That would be the argument. For the greater good.
Our fictional world, our world of films, is fascinated by the antihero, the character in the film you admire, partly because they are utterly without morality. There's a number of superhero characters who are basically bad, but somehow do good with their badness. And I think setting a thief to catch a thief, that you need to, the evil and lack of moral limits is actually quite a good thing if it serves some sort of, is a means to an end.
I think there's an underlying guilt, a suspicion that we have, a kind of a discomforting suspicion that lies underneath most of our contemporary culture, that we've probably got it wrong and that morally we're fairly bankrupt. And it's in that uncomfortable suspicion that the attraction of the psychopath, the morally ambiguous anti-hero or the serial killer appeal. You You've been listening to the Spinoza Triad podcast with myself, John Gibbs, Dr. Richard Miller, and in future episodes, hopefully Dan Rowland. If you've enjoyed our discussion and you like thinking about things like this, you can find all of our episodes on Spotify, Anchor, and many other platforms. Thank you for listening. In 1982, I found myself walking down Kentish Town High Street in North London. I'd not long graduated from university and was doing not much with my time. It was the height of the Thatcherite recession. Jobs were scarce. Unemployment was touching 3 million. I was not ready yet for a career, but considering all sorts of really quite preposterous things, being a poet, being a writer, maybe teaching, who knows what. I approached Kentish Town Job Centre and went inside. Job centres in those days, boards with small plastic cards in rows. Jobs. Data processor. Experience required. Catering assistant. Experience required. And so on. With little experience in anything, there was not much for me. But I noticed a sign which said that I should register, and if anything came up, and my details suited the position, they might contact me. I waited for my chance to have an interview, and soon enough, was called forward to a desk. A man, somewhat older than me, a shock of dark hair, glasses with dark frames. He steadily filled in the form of my details, my qualifications, the things I was planning to do. I hesitated to outline my ambitions. But when I did, he smiled and said, and I can remember it clearly, "That's a hard road." I was pleased because I expected, well, a certain look and a suggestion that I should be more realistic. A few weeks later, I had occasion to return to the job centre to see if they had found anything. I hadn't got a phone I could use, so I had to call in. The same man smiled, called me across, asked me how things were going, and we talked. He checked his index cards. There was nothing. Though I might try the Working Man's College, they were looking for volunteers for teaching. I thought I'd give that a go. I left. Some years later, not many years, a face appeared on the evening news I recognise. I'm quite good with faces, but it was the glasses, the shock of brown hair, the squarish jaw. This was Dennis Nielsen, the serial killer, who worked at Kentish Town Job Centre. He seemed nice at the time, but was living a completely double life. His colleagues liked him. He was quiet, kept himself to himself. But by the time he interviewed me, he was already well into murdering young men, luring them to his flat and killing them. When the police caught him, apparently, they asked him why he'd done it. And he said, "Well, I was really hoping you'd tell me that."